This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Philip Connors. He's the author of a new book called A Song for the River, which is, I think, a tremendously beautiful book, very personal, about, or at least set in the Gila River wilderness area, but it's about much more than the place itself. It's about some people who were there, including Phil, for a long time. How are you, Phil?
I'm doing well, David. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So maybe you could talk a little bit. I mean, this is, you know, in some ways, this is I found this a hard book to talk about or to think about how I would talk about it, because it's a narrative, but not necessarily a story in the classic sense. It's not, you know, it does have a beginning, a middle, and an end, but it's not like a novel. And it's very personal to your experience, and it felt like a like you were sharing some very deep, deeply felt emotional parts of your life that I think were hard to experience. And it, you know, the writing became the way to get through, as well as the story that you tell about being on the river, which is what the book is about.
Yeah, it was for me in many respects a hard story to tell, because much of it revolved around losses that felt borderline unbearable at the time. The deaths of friends and people I admired, the loss of an old growth forest that I had lived in and watched over for more than a decade when it burned in a massive wildfire. And so, you know, what do you do with those sorts of things that feel unbearable in the moment? The only thing I can think to do with it is to sit down, sort it out, work it through in my mind, and try to spin some kind of story out of it that's consoling, you know, first and foremost to myself, but hopefully to readers as well. So, you know, I've been thinking about it for a little while now, and I think you hit on something, that it's not necessarily a straightforward narrative that culminates in some climax and some little bit of falling action in the classic sense of a story. It kind of circles back on itself. It's not linear in time. But I wanted the shape of it to reflect what I thought of in my head as I thought about a river, and something that does swerve and circle back. And there's also the word song in the title. In some ways, I think of it as a symphony in five movements, as much as I think about it as a chapter in five books, because I wanted the language to sing, and I wanted to bring the voices of others into the story, so that I could almost harmonize along with them.
Well, the book, it did feel to me, as you're describing it, it felt very spiritual, but in that kind of way of trying to understand the inner meanings of events that have no logical explanation. You know, the way that we try to understand things that happen that otherwise don't make sense.
Yeah, I mean, when you're, in my case, I'll take one example. When you're best fire lookout friend goes for a horseback ride from his fire tower one evening, and both he and the horse don't come back. They're found dead the next day, just off the trail. The horse collapsed on top of my friend John. And all this happens just at the moment in his life when he's reached a kind of pinnacle of happiness, because he's about to be married to an incredible woman. Yeah, it just reinforces the fact that in a larger cosmic sense, justice and fairness are elusive in the universe. And so what do you do with that kind of loss and that kind of pain, and that sense of your very good friend having been denied many more years of happiness? You know, so you sift through the wreckage of it, and, you know, one thing I found in that particular case was that although John is gone, and I still rue that every day, whatever tragedy exists from that particular event is not really his anymore. It's the rest of ours. And it turns out that I became closer and closer friends all the time with his fiancée, Teresa, and her friendship, which really grew out of that sense of shared loss of someone we both loved, was a kind of consolation for that loss. We both wish, you know, we'd both rather that we weren't as close as we are now, and that she was partnered with John, and that John were still here, and my friendship with him was still ongoing. But given that that's not the case, our friendship, mine and Teresa's, has been a great consolation and solace. So, you know, if you pick through the wreckage of things, you often find little sprouts of green and little shoots of hope. So that's one of them for me.
And a similar, I mean, similar to as you described the nature of fire, complicated nature of fire in the West, or anywhere for that matter, because fire and forests in the East are, you know, have a similar relationship. You know, with there are pine trees that actually only will sprout new shoots when they're burned. And it sounds a little bit like you're describing that idea that through terrible loss is how we get to rebirth.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I suppose I was prepared to understand that message by being a fire lookout for as long as I have, 16 years now, and seeing parts of the forest where I work burn, and seeing what comes after the burn. You know, it's not just charcoal and ash forever. As soon as the first drop of rain hits a burned area, things start springing to life again. So in some ways, having experienced a major fire up close and personal in that landscape and in that forest where I worked, it became a metaphor for these other scars, which I liken to sort of burn scars, the losses of friends and people I admired, just being two of the scars. But it's remarkable how resilient humans are in a way that's sort of comparable to the resilience of the landscape I've watched over all these years.
Well, it's something about being a living being, I think, that, you know, that life has its own demand, that it demands to continue as long as it should. And I think that sometimes I don't think about that, but you just caused me to think about that a little bit, that, you know, why is it that we go on? Well, it's because that's what life demands of us.
Yeah, it's one of our deepest impulses to sort of perpetuate ourselves and extend our experience. And it's amazing what we can endure and bounce back from.
That's true. But it's also there are times when we sacrifice ourselves in order to continue someone else, you know, to save someone else, to continue something bigger, you know, which is why, you know, I mean, you talked about fire in this book. It's a really big part of the story. And you think about all those people who have to work in fire, you know, to either it's fighting or controlling. I mean, and maybe you could talk a little bit about I don't want to leave it by the actual history of the Gila wilderness and how fire, how our conceptual framework of how we deal with fire in the landscape there has changed over the last 30, 40 years, because it is really different now.
Yeah. Once upon a time, it was viewed as a scourge, a force of unmitigated destruction, and something to be snuffed out and smothered and prevented against, you know, to the best of our ability. For most of the Forest Service's existence, the goal was to have a fire contained and controlled and ideally out by 10 a.m. the morning after it was first spotted. So we spent most of the 20th century, you know, launching a kind of war on fire. And what we realized, particularly in a place like the Gila Wilderness, which is fairly arid, is that that warped the ecosystem, because there is such a thing as a fire-adapted ecosystem where the life of the place, you know, the trees, the grasses, the forbs, the mammals, the birds, they've all evolved to live with fire and to capitalize on the effects of fire. And so by removing it from the ecosystem, we damaged the ecosystem. So beginning in the late 70s on the Gila, we started trying to reintroduce fire as a sustaining force in the landscape by letting some fires burn every year instead of just immediately suppressing them. We manage them, allow them to burn, you know, within certain parameters and while also trying to protect certain other values. Obviously, we're not going to let people's homes burn down, and we're not going to try not to allow fires to have severe impacts on, say, a threatened or endangered species habitat somewhere. And it's been, you know, by and large, a success. The fires have continued to get larger and larger, especially due to climate change. But the landscape does show that it proves resilient when you let fire do its thing.
So let's talk a little bit about you being a fire watcher, essentially. You work for the Forest Service, and you've been doing this since 2002. I guess I'm curious to know what got you out there. You're from the Midwest originally, and a very different sort of landscape, different sort of lifestyle in the Midwest, even though it's prairies. Or because it is prairies, and you're now in New Mexico. The Gila is rugged. The mountains are very high. It's arid, as you said, a completely different kind of landscape. So what was it that got you out there in the first place, attracted you to stay, and took you to this unusual kind of life of living alone in a tower, watching out over thousands of acres for fires?
Well, the short answer is I had one friend in a high place, and that friend was an old friend from the University of Montana who had the job before me. And by high place, I mean when I first visited her there, she was up in her lookout tower keeping watch. She had invited me there from New York, where I was then working as an editor at the Wall Street Journal. And when I showed up there, I just immediately fell in love with the place. It was, part of it was its strangeness. I'd never spent any time in any landscape quite like it. And it was also just a chance to experience solitude on a level I never had. And so both the landscape and the opportunity to experience being alone on a mountain miles from the nearest road, both of them were very attractive. I think if you step back and take a bigger picture view of my life, one thing that's sort of ironic or maybe maybe just foreshadowing, is that I grew up on a farm in Minnesota, and if things had played out differently, who knows, I may have never left there. I may have become the fifth generation of my family to farm in that place. But during the mid-80s farm crisis, we lost a farm. And shortly afterward, the local volunteer fire department used every structure on the place in a training exercise and burned everything down. So my original home in the world, the place where I had my fiercest and first attachments to place, was wiped off the map by a fire or a series of fires. And ever after, I never felt really at home anywhere. I wandered around for years. I went to the University of Montana. I lived in Fargo, North Dakota, and Washington, D.C. for short periods. And I spent a few years in New York City. But something about the Gila really spoke to me when I first showed up there. And I realized only later that on a very long hike I took from my friend's lookout tower, I was walking through an old burn scar. But it was incredibly beautiful. Lots of aspens growing back, a few charred stumps here and there. And I was mesmerized by that forest. And that, too, was a direct result of fire. So maybe things, in some weird way, came full circle for me, and I found my home in a place destined to burn.
Well, as it happens, just by accident, I had never been to that part of New Mexico before. Earlier this year, about 6 months ago, spent about 3 days, you know, very much just at the, you know, on the edges, not certainly not going to some of the really wilderness areas, but just kind of getting a feel for the area. So I appreciate how you felt about it or how you feel about it now, because it is just a stunning place. And I thought maybe Western New Mexico along the Arizona border in that, maybe, I guess you'd call that central New Mexico more than central West. It just feels, I don't think I've ever been to a place like that. It just really is an amazing landscape, very dramatic. The mountains are incredibly beautiful. And of course, this is where Aldo Leopold was. I mean, the reason that the wilderness exists is because Aldo Leopold essentially single-handedly made it so, which is another great story.
Right, yeah. When he first came to the Southwest out of the Yale School of Forestry, in 1909, he was stationed in Arizona and New Mexico, and he, you know, he loved the wild country, but he noticed within the first decade that he was here that all these big chunks of wilderness mountains were being penetrated by roads, and within 10 years, all but one of the big wilderness areas that he had encountered when he first came out, which were more than 500,000 acres of roadless wilderness, there was only one left, and it was the Gila. And so he made a proposal to protect it in that form, unpunctured by roads and unsullied by machines and tourist developments and all things mechanized and motorized. And it became the first wilderness area to be managed that way in the United States and really the world. And 40 years later, so that went into effect in 1924. And 40 years later, when the Wilderness Act passed, the Gila was symbolically ushered in as the first wilderness under the act, because it already existed for 40 years. So that's a great deal of what makes the place special, is just that it's, you know, it's in the condition it's pretty much always been in. It hasn't been severely or adversely impacted by humans. Certainly some of our fire suppression and other things we've done in that landscape have made impacts on it, but kind of really in the big scheme of things, minor impacts, and it remains about as wild as it's ever been.
So one of the things I've learned about recently from another book I've read about beavers, called Eager, as it happens, by a guy named Ben Goldfarb, who went to the Yale Forestry School, taught me the power of beavers to make landscape. And I'm just curious, I assume that beavers were significant in the Gila, and that they probably were hunted down or out in historic times. Do you know whether that's true or not?
Yes, beavers were a major presence along all the waterways in the Gila, the main fork of the main stem of the Gila River and the three forks. And people who came here earliest as Europeans anyway, which was still fairly late in the scheme of things, aside from a few Spanish wanderers, they were looking for beaver pelts in the early 1800s, 1820s.
Yep.
And they took beavers by the score. And there remain some in the watershed here and there. If you get out and hike or take a boat trip, you'll see evidence of beaver activity, but nothing on the scale of what it used to be. And, you know, that's changed the watershed somewhat because beavers used to slow down the passage of water through the watershed, and they would create marshes and giant pools and swampy areas. And without them there, the water just moves through the watershed quicker than it used to.
Right. Yeah, it changes the habitat. You get fewer opportunities for all kinds of other animals, and it also makes it more prone to flooding and that erosion that you see as the river digs down deeper and deeper into the land, which, you know, the beavers would have slowed down. Kind of interesting. But, you know, speaking of the river, that's another thing. And beavers, the idea of damming the Gila, you talk about that in the book. And I'm just, I couldn't believe that the wilderness area would be able to be breached in that way. And what's the latest on the plan that you outlined? And I know you wrote about also last year in the LA Times. But what's the latest about the Gila River Dam project?
Well, it's the idea and the proposal continues to grind its way through the bureaucracy here. It would be built actually just outside of the wilderness, right where the river leaves the wilderness. So not much about the construction of the dam would impact the wilderness itself. But it's also the case that the Gila is a living river well beyond the wilderness boundary, and the dam would make it not that anymore. It would dewater the river, dry it up, and impound the water off-site. There's a deadline of about, 14 months from now for the Secretary of the Interior in Washington, D.C. to make what's called a record of decision about whether the state of New Mexico can proceed with building a dam. In the meantime, the proposal has to undergo NEPA analysis, which is essentially a rigorous environmental review of its impacts on all sorts of things, including endangered species. And it's really hard to see how the proposal could account for the presence of endangered species downstream of the dam. But having watched the folks interested in having it built long enough now, I can see that they're prepared to make any argument or massage any data in the service of trying to get the thing built, because that's just what engineers and water commissioners do in the West. They're eager beavers. They like to build dams. And the Gila is one of the last unspoiled, undammed upper watersheds in the entire West. Further down in Arizona, it is dammed and dried up. But in New Mexico, it still runs wild and free. And kind of like the way Leopold decided there was one big piece of country left and should be protected as such, we're arguing, you know, we have one river left in the state of New Mexico that's not dammed, re-engineered, and turned into plumbing for cities and farming. And let's just let us have the last one. You know, let us have one wild river. So we'll continue to advocate for that, and we'll hope that an honest environmental review would show just how disastrous this dam project would be for all the life that depends on the river.
Well, one hopes, but does not. I don't think one can afford to trust this particular administration in Washington to tell the truth about anything. So, as a consequence, I think it's best to be prepared for the worst and to try to do whatever is necessary to defend the river for as long as possible.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Expecting the current Secretary of the Interior to act in the interest of science rather than the interests of industry or construction companies or whoever might profit from spoiling the land is a fool's errand. But, you know, we'll be working other avenues. There's an election for the governor of New Mexico this fall, and a new governor with a different attitude about the environment and natural resource issues could be a welcome boon for our cause. And we're also pushing for wild and scenic river designation for the Gila. It's sort of the Wilderness Act equivalent for moving water in the United States. This year, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, which, if a river achieves that designation, affords it protection from destructive developments. So we're leaning on our members of Congress and our U.S. senators in New Mexico to put forth some legislation to protect the Gila as a wild and scenic river, and we have our fingers crossed that with a lot of grassroots effort and support, we can maybe make that come to fruition.
Are there any organizations that people who are not in New Mexico can join or follow that you could recommend for anyone who's listening who might be interested in saving one of the last wild rivers in America?
Yeah, absolutely. New Mexico Wild, which was formerly known as the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, has taken the lead on Gila River protection issues and the wild and scenic designation push. They're longtime and very dedicated and articulate advocates for all things wild in New Mexico, and they've invested a lot of effort in the Gila River issue. There's a newer nonprofit group that I've been trumpeting and trying to raise money for called Heart of the Gila, and it's located right in Gila Hot Springs, where the three forks of the Gila River come together and merge to form the main stem. And they do a lot of really cool stuff. A lot of it's education-centered. They have a project called Navigable Learning, where they've built their own custom cataracts to take policymakers, politicians, and others interested in the ecology of the river, decision-makers, down the river in periods of low flow, because it's not always floatable in a kayak. The flow is so variable. Sometimes in the summer, it gets down to 10 cubic feet per second, which is just barely a trickle, really. But they've built these cataracts to be able to float the river in a lot of different conditions, and they're showing it to people who can make a difference. And they're also doing trail clearing projects along the forks of the river and doing education projects centered around bringing children to the river to help them understand the ecology of it and introduce the river, in some cases, to kids who've never even visited it before, even though they live 30 miles away. So Heart of the Gila is also doing great work. Those are the two I would point people toward. And then, well, the Gila Conservation Coalition is also an umbrella organization that does really great work, very locally focused on the Gila River and the Gila Wilderness. And they're on the top of their game too, keeping an eye on this and monitoring all the public meetings and responding to all the nonsense that's come out of the bureaucracies that are pushing for the dam.
Well, it's always a lot of work to defend something that, and it's really easy, well, relatively easier to destroy it. So really appreciate the work that people do in behalf of the river and the wilderness. I wanted to mention one other thing before I want to ask you to read a little bit from the book, and that is that one of the other losses in the book that you talk about are these three young kids, teenagers, who were killed in a plane crash, in a way helping to take care, themselves taking care of the river, trying to study it and understand it. And I just, I don't want you to necessarily have to give away too much of the story, but just to mention that, I think in honor of those kids' lives, I think it would be good to mention them.
Yeah, they were remarkable teenagers. They were students at a local charter school, and they did a lot of environmental education work, both as students and as teachers of other younger kids. And yeah, tragically, they were on a study mission of the watershed and a little burn scar that had happened. And upon returning to the airport in Silver City, just a 10-minute flight away from where they were studying the watershed, the plane crashed, and it was a massive blow to the community. The loss of three kids and the pilot who'd volunteered his time to take them on this mission. And they were all advocates for the wild. One of them had single-handedly gathered more than 6,000 signatures on her self-authored petition to protect the Gila River from the dam. She had delivered those signatures to the state legislature in New Mexico and testified about the issue before the state legislature. And so, although she was only 14 years old at the time of her death, she was perhaps our most eloquent, articulate, passionate advocate for a wild Gila River. And so part of what I wanted to do in this book was carry her voice on, because it still inspires so many of us. And her mother is actually the person who founded the Heart of the Gila nonprofit to further the work of Ella Jazz Kirk, was her name. And so I hope the book does honor to the lives and passions of those kids and brings their voices from beyond into our present moment, because they were preternaturally articulate and intelligent and far-seeing in the way they viewed the world and the human place in it. And I just hope the book in some small way does honor to them and keeps their voices alive.
Well, at least for me, it did. And I believe that it does for others as well. Do you mind, Phil, reading just a little bit from the book so people can get a sense of the writing? I think we haven't really talked about the writing, but it is, I thought, just luminous and beautiful writing, and I thought really good if you could share a little bit of it.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I'm going to read something right from the beginning of the book, and it's just a couple of paragraphs, but it kind of sums up the main obsessions in the book, which are have to do both with fire and with water. To watch a mountain you love murmur and chirp and howl and green up from rain and bloom with flowers, then see it succumb to flame and be blackened by heat, only to live once more from the ashes, was to absorb an object lesson in transience and renewal. From my perch above the shaggy pines and stately firs, I looked down on a world burning itself up, most of us burning ourselves up in work and striving and the peculiar game of consumption and accumulation without end. The whole world on fire from our appetites and their cost. And I sometimes thought it would not be a terrible fate to lie down for the last time in ashes, preferably on a mountain. On a mountain, ashes do not remain still for long. They are worked on by wind and water and follow ancient courses decreed by the laws of hydrology, which are determined by the laws of gravity. When enough of these water courses converge in a form that pulses and recedes but does not cease, we call the convergence a river. In the mud along the banks of the river, mud dappled by the paw prints of bears, were remnants not just of the forests and the mountains, but of people I had loved and admired, and their remnants also arrived there, having been transfigured by flame to ash.
Yeah, that's very beautiful. I like that. Thanks for reading that. Well, you know, it was really good talking to you, Phil. I really appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation. We've been talking about A Song for the River by Philip Connors, also known as Phil, published by Cinco Puntos Press. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Thank you, Phil.